Welcome to the Everyone's a Critic Movie Review Podcast. I'm your co-host, Bob Zarrell.
I mean, who wants to have sex with a guy named Bob?
Oh, Bob. Just doesn't sound right. Oh, Bob.
Bob.
Oh, Bob.
Oh, Bob.
Bob.
Oh,
Bob. Bob. Bob.
With me, as always, is professional film critic Sean Patrick.
I am too smart. S-M-R-T. I mean, S-M-A-R-T.
And Josh Adams.
That's Jaime. Protege of mine. Ranked number 32 in the federal prison system.
32?
That's right.
Out of what, 20?
Visit us at IHateCritics.net, EveryonesACriticPodcast.com, or on Facebook. Our Twitter and Instagram handles are CriticsPod. There you can participate in our movie fights, top fives, see the movies that are turning 30, Sean's reviews, general discussion. We also are at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, all your podcatchers. Subscribe to the show, rate and review the show. It helps us move up the charts. And then Patreon, ihatecritics.net/Patreon. It's the best way to help support the podcast. But I've also added a PayPal link at ihatecritics.net if you'd rather donate via PayPal instead of Patreon, if that's your thing. Either way, it helps us out. So whatever's easiest for you. We also have merch at ihatecritics.net in the podcast merch tab. There's three different shirts, mugs, whatever you want to get with those designs on them. That also helps out the podcast. Not so much monetarily, but a little bit, but more advertising and word of mouth. Let's see. That's the normal starting stuff, I think.
Yeah.
So sure. Let's get to, we have a huge show. That's why I'm, this is going to be like a 4-hour show. So we have one trailer for you, and it is Us, Jordan Peele's new movie.
Yeah, with Lupita Nyong'o. Tremendous actress, and really great-looking trailer. Really surprising and shocking. It reminded me a little bit of Hereditary in some ways, and that's always a good thing for me anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I thought Strangers a little bit, but then it went its own. It just even more artistic than that was. That's just pure scary. This one, there's something... There's more depth to this one. At least it appears that way from the trailer. I can't wait. The fact that I don't know what it's about is exciting.
Yeah, that would be my angle, too. I have no idea what the movie's about. And as a result, that's somehow more intriguing. I don't know. Plus, Jordan Peele's last movie, anything that he does going forward, I'm kind of intrigued with because of how unabashedly original that was.
Yeah.
Take note, marketers. You can make a trailer where you don't have to give away everything.
Take note, studios. You can let people be creative and do something outside of the norm.
No, they need to satisfy their stockholders first. They need to make sure that it makes the requisite amount of money or they won't fund it.
Yeah, but I'm excited about this one. It'll be a nice breath of fresh air. But in terms of... Any news, really, other than Kevin Spacey's creepy? His trailer was way more creepy than Us.
What a total creep! What is this guy thinking? I can't get a beat on just what exactly he thought was going to happen, putting this out the same day that he's about to be indicted.
But he like halfway addresses it in the video. It's weird.
I haven't watched the most recent seasons of House of Cards, so I have no idea where his character is supposed to be, other than I guess I heard that he's dead, because that was actually in a Netflix promo, his wife standing over his grave. So I don't know how he thinks he's coming back from that.
Or this.
Maybe it's a Dave situation, and that there's a lookalike, you know. But that, I mean, as a guy that called Kevin Spacey his favorite actor for roughly a decade or so, this is pretty much about the worst possible thing that could happen. It would be as if Ryan Sandberg went out and murdered somebody and was on trial. You know, it's one of those feelings of initial pride coming back on you. And
yeah.
It's awful, and I feel bad for the victims in this case, but my own personal feelings took a hit when he was accused.
Oh yeah, I'm with you. At one point, I don't know if it was a full decade, but I definitely called him my favorite actor for a period.
Have you seen there's a YouTube video now of somebody who's doing like director's commentary on the video, giving him, going over the advice that he was trying to give him when he was doing it. When he's doing it, it's fantastic. It's, and there's so many memes, so many of the people on Twitter just making this into a massive meme. He just looks like a total jackass.
I can't believe this is real. Like, it is.
When I saw it, I thought, I honestly didn't think it was. Like, when I first, like, saw Kevin Spacey trending on Twitter, I'm like, what is this about? And then I read somebody talking about it, and I'm like, no, he didn't really do that. And he did. But I saw it. Anyway. To the point where one of our favorite writers, Nathan Rabin, is going to do a My World of Flops on Kevin Spacey.
Okay, let's get to the 15 new movies we got this week, and we'll start with Aquaman.
The biggest
one of all of them.
Massive monster hit, already up around, what, $500 million worldwide? That's not too bad. This is the latest from DC Comics. The buzz had been very strong on this coming out, to the point where some were saying it is better than Wonder Woman, which I would say, no, it's not. But it's quite good on its own, in its own way, much better than I ever expected it to be. This is not an origin story, which is nice. We do get kind of an origin story, but it's mostly just a story about him returning to Atlantis for the first time and essentially trying to reclaim the throne very, very reluctantly from his brother, played by Patrick Wilson. Of course, he's pushed to this by Amber Heard, who's his kind of love interest. And, you know, there's a lot of big action, lots of silliness, lots of goofiness, and I really enjoyed the silly side of Aquaman. That's really the best part of it for me. James Wan is really good at big, silly, stupid action, as he showed with the Fast and the Furious movies, and he makes this one big and silly and colorful and exciting. It worked for me. It worked well enough that I liked it.
It's definitely more impressive than I expected it to be upon announcement. And knowing Jason Momoa as an actor doesn't have a whole lot of range. He plays a note, and he just plays it ad nauseum. And that's okay if you like Jason Momoa, which I kind of do, as he is. I just took Aquaman in DC Comics a little bit more seriously than what I purported Momoa to be. But they've surrounded him, as they have with Henry Cavill before him, et cetera, with a strong supporting cast, especially Nicole Kidman. She's so very needed in this movie. She grounds it in particular scenes. She's fierce in scenes. And Willem Dafoe, for that matter, too. He's not usually his creepy, weird self. He's a supportive character here who's doing something behind the scenes. Amber Heard is really the one doing everything behind the scenes in this film. But the visuals are really, really cool. I got the sense of both deep water, which is something that I fear, and it gets me hooked when I'm looking at it on screen, and also of a real world underneath the water. So it doesn't look ridiculous, which is the whole fear of Aquaman going in. And so that is an accomplishment all on its own. Is it resonant like Wonder Woman, or I would say even Batman versus Superman? No. In terms of ranking the DC films thus far, I would go Wonder Woman, Batman versus Superman, this, and Man of Steel are pretty much on the same footing for me. I think that Man of Steel has a good. Every time I watch it, it gets better. I think Aquaman will have good rewatchability. I think that's really all that we needed out of this. I guess if there's anything to be slightly disappointed in, it would be that although we're asking these superhero films to be good on their own and to not have to rely on other stories, it would have been interesting to know how the rest of the superhero team that we're aware of is reacting to what's going on to Aquaman. It would have been nice to see Superman show up at some point. Or the scene in Man of Steel, I think it was, where maybe it's Batman versus Superman, where they discover the kryptonite at the bottom of the Indian Ocean because of all of the world engine from Man of Steel and whatnot. That was supposed to be the thing that got Aquaman into the foray. They've completely ignored that part. So we've got our first instance of DC comic films not retconning, but ignoring something that they did, they were supposed to revisit. I'm happy with it. I think that's really all that I could ask for, that it's not a disappointment.
Yeah, I would say in terms of rewatchability, it's probably the most rewatchable, other than the fact that it's super freaking long, 2.5 hours. But, I mean, it plays like your silly action movie, Lethal Weapon, when we were, you know, that kind of thing. And for that, it succeeds. And, you know, Jason Momoa plays one note, but that note is badass, and he does that well. So to have Aquaman be the most badass character in the DC universe is kind of weird, but it works.
Turns around the memes a little bit, I guess. And there's also a giant octopus that plays the drums. That's pretty cool.
That's true. Yeah.
That reminded me of some Baby Einstein videos. From my mermaid. Yeah, that too, of course.
It's funny because a lot of other people were saying it was reminding them of Mad Max.
Yeah, interesting, yeah. That's right.
But, I mean, it's definitely... They did a good job. It's making money, and it's just not, I don't know, it's not a groundbreaking movie by any means.
No, not at all. I don't think it was supposed to be, though. I think it's supposed to be Fast and Furious in the water.
Right.
I enjoyed this far more than the one Fast and Furious movie that I saw, but I was only 22 years old, different person. Maybe I should watch this. Well, no, I'm not going to.
Well, and I don't know about you, but I'm not a car guy at all, so... There is nothing for me in the Fast and Furious movies, so it's not even fun.
There's one car movie. It's Bullet. That's it. That's all I really care about. But, yeah.
I like Death Proof a little bit, I guess. Vanishing was pretty good, if I remember right. But, anyway, we can move on to another car movie, I suppose. Bumblebee.
Yeah, I love Bumblebee. Bumblebee's awesome. This is the first time I've seen a good Transformers movie. I never thought they could actually do that. But then I've never seen a Transformer movie that wasn't made by Michael Bay, who's just a complete hack who doesn't know how to direct a movie. And this is like the proof of concept on that, because somebody else has taken the thing that he's been working on for so very long and actually done it right. The story is set in 1987. Bumblebee is sent to Earth by Optimus Prime to be its protector. He arrives on Earth and encounters a military group led by John Cena and a Decepticon that followed him to Earth, who he gets into a big fight with and leaves him beaten and battered and without his memory. Eventually, he shuts down and becomes a broken-down bug. It was discovered by Haley Steinfeld, who rebuilds him and puts him back together, and suddenly he's alive again. But he doesn't know who he is, and there's a journey of discovery going on, and it's really a lovely story. It's really well made. It's the you actually can see the Transformer in the transform in the way that you're supposed to see a Transformer transform. You actually get to see it when they're fighting. You can actually see the action taking place. You can actually make out which character is doing what for the first time. It's not just this clattering cacophony of chaos. It's this actual fight scene that's happening. It's really awesome. And John Cena's pretty fantastic in this movie. He's got a great character. He's kind of a villain, kind of a hero. I really loved this movie. Haley Steinfeld is fantastic. She is such a great character, and the way she humanizes Bumblebee and the makes him feel so real, she's just amazing. I really love this movie.
Did you get a chance to see it?
No, I tried to, but apparently don't ever plan a wedding around Christmas time, because then if you have a side gig as a podcast guy that sees movies, you'll just never do it. But I like your little phrase there. It's alliteration at its best, and you ran right through that clattering cacophony of chaos. Very nice.
I always use that when I talk about Transformers.
As well you should.
Yeah, again, it's just a silly little action movie. But it's so much... I don't know... Like, I can't decide if it's that good or the other Transformers are that bad. I do like it more than Aquaman. I think it's more watchable than Aquaman there. It's shorter. I like the use of music versus score. I thought Aquaman... I didn't have a problem with Aquaman's score, per se, but I really liked the way Bumblebee used popular music in moments where I thought Aquaman could have. Mm-hmm. But it's more rewatchable, I would say, for sure. What bothers me about it is that I wish this was the very first one they ever made.
Yeah, you know? If it was the only Transformers movie, how great would that be?
And, I mean, I look at the beginning of the movie, there's a little bit of that craziness where it's kind of fast and shaky cam, and you can't totally understand what's going on, but
it kind of works here because it makes it, there's actually a tension there. I think, you know, I feel like if I watch it again, I'll understand the tension more.
Yeah,
I'm pulling the other Transformers when I'm watching it for the first time, like thinking, okay, I don't know if this is a great start. But as I get away from it, I'm thinking that might, it does kind of work, you know, the cluster, because there's a lot of tension there. And the way that Travis Knight, is that his name? The way he,
yeah,
the way he directs it is so much more, I don't know, everything just means more. And you're right, Haley Steinfeld just really holds this movie together, and John Cena gets to essentially play Aquaman. You know, Jason, he plays the badass.
Yeah.
And he's funny without being funny. I don't know. He's just, I'm curious if they do the G.I. Joe thing.
Right.
I'm okay if, you know, if they, I don't know. You still have to have the right people doing it. But then at the same time, I go back to my whole, but I want these people making, you know, Us and Hereditary and other movies that A24 is doing.
Another Kubo and the Two Strings.
Right. Instead of, you know, just like Brie Larson's doing. I'm sure Captain Marvel will be great, but I want to see Brie Larson do three small movies that year instead of one huge movie or two huge movies.
There's a lot of laughs in this movie. That's what I really love. This has got, unlike Transformers, which was just a tone-deaf black hole of humor, this is actually a very funny movie. There's a line that John Cena has that is one of the funniest things I've heard all year. He's talking about Decepticons, and he's like, it's literally in their name, Decepticon. Oh, great.
But the way he delivered it isn't perfect. Cheesy. I mean, it works for the movie.
She uses a Smith song, or Bumblebee uses a Smith song as a punchline at one point, which is fantastic. The end fight scene is phenomenal. What a great job amping up the tension in that moment. It was great.
I wonder if the fact that it's such a smaller scale movie that makes it so they could have made it so it made more sense. I don't know.
Yeah, if there were more Transformers in it, I think it would get as noisy and stupid as what Michael Bay does.
Because at some point, I mean, can you make it without it getting noisy and stupid if you have that many Transformers in it? I don't know.
I wonder.
But I don't know.
I kind of want to see Travis Knight try now.
I'd go back and give it another shot for sure.
But then again, how did this movie do? It didn't do
about 40, 50 million.
That's not there.
That's about where it tracked at least a month or two ago. So at least it met their expectations. And I think it may have a little bit of staying power because the critical response as well as the fan response has been stronger than it definitely was expected to be, as well as better than any of the Transformers films. Even the fan score was much higher than the Transformers franchise.
It's only at 40 million, but that's only nationally, or it's 71 worldwide.
I don't know if that, I don't know if you're Paramount, you're looking at that going, that's enough.
But I mean, I don't know what the budget was, 135 million. So they're going to probably just break even or maybe a little more.
Yes. I don't know if it matters or not, but something to keep an eye on is the parent company for these films, Hasbro. They had a rough 2018. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, up on that news. And they had a super down year with all of their major properties, including Star Wars and Transformers. So considering that there was a movie in the year for both of those properties, there's talk about how Hasbro may or may not keep their licenses going forward. So I'm sure that anything in the Transformers franchise that they do has to hinge on whether or not they're going to keep the properties or continue making toys, et cetera, et cetera.
There's a big question to have about the business decision to open this movie this weekend. I know there was a lot of room with people off work and whatnot and the kids out of school, but, you know, 2 weeks ago, we had an empty weekend where Schindler's List was the only wide release. Why Bumblebee wasn't on that weekend and pulling in a $50 to $60 million opening weekend with plenty of room to roll until Aquaman came out and still having, you know, it would have what this weekend it could be doing anywhere in the 20 to, you know, $10 to $20 million for this week while they're off of school. With the reviews behind it, they missed this opportunity. They screwed this up really bad opening this the way they did.
For toys as well.
Right. And it's not just Aquaman. I mean, Holmes and Watson, you have that audience that might have gone to this. Even Mary Poppins Returns, part of that audience could have gone to this, and they may have chose that instead, or absolutely, you know, the parents. So, yeah, I don't know. I do think, though, that this one will stick around. I think it'll have a life on the streaming services where kids watch it over and over again, because it is that good and that rewatchable, more so than a lot of these action movies that we've gotten lately. But while we're here, Holmes and Watson.
Holmes and Watson. Oh, what a piece of crap. I know I was going into this with a very negative attitude because I don't like Talladega Nights and I don't like Step Brothers. And so I was kind of prepared to hate this, and I'm hating it just as much as I thought I would. But honestly, I just don't understand what it is that Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly do for each other. All they do is yell at each other and then violently attack each other. And then they do these big, stupid physical bits. And that's it. And I don't see why any of that is funny. And this is supposed to be a parody of Sherlock Holmes, and really the parody never arrives. It's kind of they're kind of not playing it straight, but there's not really any essence of parody to it. Like, they don't make his Holmes all that ridiculous. Like, he's right throughout. Like, he's you know, as smart as he seems to be. Like, he's guessing, you know, he's guessing all the bad guys' moves and whatnot. So I don't understand what they're going for there. There's the opening of this movie has like four running gags going all at once. So you've got Holmes trying to get to the trial of Moriarty, played by Ralph Fiennes. He's got to be there by noon, or the guy or Moriarty gets free. But during this time, he's also got to pick a hat. He can't decide on which hat he wants. So they have to do the bit with the hat, and then they've got a bit with a mosquito and killer bees. And then they've got, then once they actually get to the courthouse with all these three running bits going on, they start another running bit about how this isn't really Moriarty. It's a guy who's a chronic masturbator, and we got to come up with 15 different riffs on how to say masturbation without actually saying masturbation. And I'm just pulling my hair out. Just pick a fucking joke. Just pick one that's funny instead of trying to come up with 15 all at once. The movie just keeps heaping garbage on top of you, trying desperately to find something's funny, and it never does. There's one funny character in the entire movie. It's Lauren Lapkus. And for most of the movie, they don't even let her character talk. She talks at the end, and it finally gets funny.
Yeah, one of the downsides of the Judd Apatow, Adam McKay school of directing, I guess, is the... just say a million different things and we'll capture the best part. The thing is, they would cut stuff out and they just pick the one.
Right.
You watch the deleted scenes and sure, it's funny in that context. But now you're seeing a lot of movies, like a movie that comes to mind, I don't know why, but Bad Grandpa, though, with Seth De Niro and...
yeah.
It was just, they would not... they just kept telling... every line had to be a joke to the point where it just stopped being... even if they were funny jokes by themselves... together, it got boring and unfunny.
Sisters did that. The House with Will Ferrell and Amy Poehler did that. Yeah, I think some have called it line-o-rama, where they're just kind of throwing out line after line, after riff, trying to get to a funny joke.
Which, I think you need a better director to rein it in. You know, that's okay if you're going to shoot it that way, but you can't leave them all in the movie.
Right.
And so that's disappointing. I mean, I do like Talladega Nights. I'm not as big a Step Brothers fan as a lot of people are, but I do think Talladega Nights is funny, but I was not looking forward to this one. It didn't look that good from the trailer, and the way you're describing it, it seems to be the problem with a lot of movies anymore, or a lot of bad comedies, just too many jokes and not enough direction.
And mostly, I mean, just Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly just like to yell at each other and then get into slap fights. And that's severely diminishing returns after a while.
Well, yeah, when the same thing, it just gets old after a while. And the one thing I do like about Will Ferrell is, you know, we talk about Adam Sandler not caring, but Will Ferrell really doesn't care, but in a way that he doesn't care if you like it or not. He almost thinks it's funny when it's so unfunny sometimes, and... mm-hmm. I can kind of appreciate that about him. That's kind of what works sometimes on Saturday Night Live with him. If something was so bad, it ended up being funny. But more than anything, I like him in a supporting role. You know, the funniest scenes in Step Brothers when you had another actor and they're actually carrying the movie. You talk about Lauren Lapkus in this carrying a scene. Talladega Nights had other actors that came in and made it work when it did work. So,
I mean, Sacha Baron Cohen is 50 times funnier than either John C. Reilly or Will Ferrell in that movie.
When you look at Old School, you have the straight guy, Luke Wilson, you know, handing it off to Vince Vaughn and Will Ferrell instead of them trying to lead it. And I mean, Vince Vaughn suffers the same thing. As a lead, he's not nearly as funny as he is as a supporting character, but I don't know. This movie seems to have disappeared.
Good. Needs to be buried in a landfill somewhere.
Speaking of buried in a landfill somewhere, Dick Cheney.
if only.
Vice.
Vice is Adam McKay's attempt at making a movie about Dick Cheney. I don't know why he wanted to make this movie. I've seen this movie twice now. I still don't understand it. It's the story of, you know, Dick Cheney basically coming up in Wyoming, and he's going nowhere. His wife finally forces him to turn his life around. She gets him into college. He then decides to get into politics. He sees Donald Rumsfeld and becomes his acolyte, essentially deciding at that point that he's a Republican. He's kind of an opportunist for most of the time, to the point where there's a joke where he says to Donald Rumsfeld, "What is it that we do believe?" And that's the punchline. What do we believe? No, we don't really believe in anything. Steve Carell is basically playing like a Saturday Night Live character as Donald Rumsfeld.
Donald Rumsfeld was playing Saturday Night Live character, but yeah.
I mean, that's what everybody's doing, aside from Christian Bale, who takes this very, very seriously to the point where he ruins any type of parody or joke. He's taking this Dick Cheney very seriously. He plays the whole thing very straight, and I'm not sure what his intent was versus the intent of Adam McKay. Not that he makes him appealing, because there's nothing appealing about Dick Cheney, but he at least plays it so straight and so realistic that, yeah, he's a bastard, but he's a pretty average bastard. He just happened to rise to the most powerful position in the world.
Yeah, for me, I guess I thought everybody was taking it seriously but Steve Carell, which still, either way, it doesn't work because of it's not a consistency. And did you see it yet, Josh?
Nope.
There's not a consistency in the acting. I think Christian Bale is really good in it. I think Amy Adams is good. I think Sam Rockwell is good. He's hardly in it.
Yeah.
You know, they talk about, you show all the clips in the trailer, basically. But I really kind of felt like this was just Fox News for liberals. You know, we don't know what's true, what's not true. Mm-hmm. It's definitely, you're picking your audience and going, I'm going all in here. But unlike, God, I always forget the name of the
Big Short.
The Big Short. Unlike that one, which everybody can kind of relate to, even though you're still going to, it's a liberal conservative thing. But this one is just definitely, they don't have all the stories. They make stuff up. They have fun with it at times, but I don't know. It's not as effective because, you know, it's just preaching to the choir, but it's also not necessarily totally true because they're just taking liberties right and left.
And it does what The Big Short did. It basically just rips off The Big Short using its little bit about taking little skits, you know, the little skits that they did in The Big Short where they're like cut to Selena Gomez and an economist talking about the housing crisis. Well, here instead they do like Dick Cheney and Lynn Cheney speaking in Shakespearean language about his decision to run for vice president, or they'll do a bit where Alfred Molina comes on as a waiter and is helping them decide what types of torture they think should be legal and how they can make it legal, but he's doing it like he's reading it from a wine list.
Right.
And those moments, I guess, are kind of funny, but again, the joke is just always just a little bit off to the side.
Not funny enough.
Yeah.
It wasn't really, you know, obviously The Big Short's not going to be fun. It's going to piss you off, and that's kind of the appeal to it. This doesn't really do either, because if you really follow politics, you know they're taking liberties, so you can't totally get behind the movie. But the cinema's not that fun either. It's kind of fun here and there, but it's not fun enough.
Yeah, and it's also, it's kind of insulting.
And
Big Short kind of was as well. Like, the only way you're going to listen to economics is if I put Margot Robbie in a bathtub. Then you're going to listen to economics. The only way you're going to the only way you're going to enjoy this movie is that I'm going to do these little skits, or you're going to, you know, it's going to, just like the focus group thing that they do in the movie was really truly insulting, where they're just outright hateful to anybody who wasn't paying every bit of attention to Dick Cheney.
But with The Big Short, though, they're people weren't paying attention.
Yeah.
And so there's actually a point to that.
Right.
And here is just kind of like, again, I don't know. At the same time, though, Christian Bale's fantastic. I mean, he is Dick Cheney. But that's kind of, that's where it begins and ends for me, really. Anything else on Vice?
I don't recommend it.
Yeah, really disappointing, really, because yeah. I was the most excited about this one coming into the holiday. Mary, Queen of Scots.
Yeah, Mary, Queen of Scots. I was a little bit suspicious of this one when they didn't send it out for year-end awards, and there's a reason why, because it's basically just a mid-century soap opera. The idea That's
disappointing.
Yeah. Saoirse Ronan plays Mary, Queen of Scots. She's returning from France, where she was married to the King of France for a time, and now she's returning to Scotland to assume the throne there. She is the cousin of Queen Elizabeth, and she has a claim to the Elizabeth's throne in a way. And if she can produce an heir to that throne, then she will definitely have a line of succession in her favor. She's kind of, you know, it's basically just about a little maneuver here and a little maneuver there, and who's in power and who's in favor and whatnot. And it doesn't really go anywhere. You know, Saoirse Ronan's good. Margot Robbie's good, but Margot Robbie's barely there.
Really?
Yeah. She's not really given much time in this movie. It's called Mary, Queen of Scots for a reason. It's about Saoirse Ronan's character. And she just doesn't have much of a character to play. This character is interesting, but it's not really, I don't know, there's nothing really relevant about it. There's nothing, it doesn't stand out in anything. It just is like a kind of a potboiler drama beach read of mid-centuries politics.
All right, then The Favorite will just kind of stay there. Because I saw this one, and I mean, I'd say it's a little better than what you described, but not too. I mean, the acting I thought was really good in this movie, but the story itself I didn't really care about. Does that make sense?
Sure, sure. Olivia Colman, Rachel Weisz, Emma Stone, and another story about a queen, and lots of more sexual politics in this movie, which I dig. I thought that was really fascinating. This movie really uses sex in a very unique and kind of ugly way.
Right.
Which is really interesting. Emma Stone just is a poor girl who just arrives in court looking for a job. She's the cousin of Rachel Weisz's character, so she kind of takes pity on her. Rachel Weisz is the best friend of the queen, and has used her position to build her power base, and essentially is kind of running things until Emma Stone kind of insinuates herself in there. I love the way Yorgos Lanthimos builds this rivalry between these characters, and the almost accidental cunning of Emma Stone's character versus the actual cunning of Rachel Weisz's character is a really wonderful dynamic. Emma Stone is somebody who's like pretending to be smart the whole time, and she thinks she's doing the smart thing the whole time.
She did a much better job of Dick Cheney than and he did good.
Yeah. Whereas Rachel Weisz is amazing in this movie. She's so good. She just absolutely kills this movie. I loved it. I loved her. And this was an honorable mention in my top 10 of the year.
Like I said, I loved the acting. Emma Stone, so you just don't see her playing roles like this.
Mm-hmm.
Not that she's not a good actor, because she is, but this is definitely something you've never seen her in. You know, the sexual politics kind of it's not really the character she normally plays, but she really nails it. And her and Rachel Weisz, or Weisz, however you pronounce it, their chemistry, I don't know. It's a good movie that I don't think I'd watch a lot, I guess is more what I'm getting. But I really did, I just dug the acting in this movie. The acting was top notch, and that to me, that was the best part of the movie, more so than anything else. All right, three more. Welcome to Marwen.
Welcome to Marwen. This one's on my worst of the year list. Welcome to Marwen stars Steve Carell as a guy who makes, I guess he's an artist who takes pictures of kind of these Barbie doll characters that he's turned into, these World War II characters, and they're based off of real women in his life. In this fictional village that he's built called Marwen, they're there to protect his character from harm. He's a guy who was assaulted by a group of guys who were kind of white supremacists who attacked him because they assumed he was gay. And they beat him up to the point where he lost all of his memories prior to the attack. So he lost his ability to draw, his ability to do, you know, the job that he was doing before. And now he's just kind of does this. A woman moves in across the street, played by Leslie Mann, who he kind of fixates on and kind of turns her into his love interest, whether she wants to be or not. And really, all you need to do is kind of change the score, and this becomes a thriller. Like, he becomes he becomes a serial killer, honestly. Like, he's a guy who makes dolls of his closest female friends, and it's like just one edit away from him being like the biggest creep on the planet. Steve Carell plays the character as if he's a creep, and I don't feel sorry for this guy. I feel like he's just this close to just snapping and just killing everybody around him.
You guys don't make dolls of your female friends? I think Josh and I are on the same page here. I thought it was normal.
He also wears women's shoes, which is an odd choice, but it is okay. So at one point, Leslie Mann tries to be nice to him by giving him a pair of her shoes, and yeah, he starts wearing those around. That's not weird, though. I mean, go ahead, wear women's shoes if that's what makes you happy. That doesn't bother me about this character. It's everything else about this character that is so creepy. And they turn this, you know, seemingly, like, the guy in the documentary Marwen Call, I guess, is just an artist, and he's kind of odd, but his, you know, his friends really care about him, and the movie doesn't frame him as a creep, whereas this movie kind of frames this guy as a creep. I mean, there's an actual scene where one of his friends comes to visit him, and he's set up a scene that he's taking pictures of, and it's her with her top ripped open by the Nazis. And she comes in and just, why is my top open? It's like, oh, you're so funny. That's not weird at all.
Boys will be boys.
Who doesn't strip their Barbie that looks like their close friend and put them in rape scenes and in their art? I mean, who doesn't do that, right?
I mean, I don't do the rape scene thing, but
right. Princess Leia played many characters when I was young. So did Scarlet from the G.I. Joe line.
That is kind of a creepy idea. But
honestly, though, I mean, you just need to change the score of this movie and it becomes a thriller. It becomes a creepy thriller.
So whose fault is it? Zemeckis?
Zemeckis, absolutely. He doesn't know what he's doing here. He's so focused on the cool technology that brings these dolls to life and has them act out scenes that I don't think he really gives a fuck about what Carell's doing.
That's not good.
It always seems like he's on the verge of trying to do something new or innovative when it comes to film, but it seems like his stories have gone by the wayside in recent years. And it seems like, based on what you've talked about with Zemeckis, that you would agree that anything post Back to the Future, post Roger Rabbit, even, would be no. And I,
anything to in the a 2000s, point, pretty much, yeah.
I mean, What Lies Beneath was fun at times, you know.
Half
but,
of a really fascinating bad movie.
yeah. I guess that's true. But in terms of technological innovation, I'm thinking of Beowulf. I'm trying not to, but Polar Express.
Yeah.
The Walk with Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Am I right about that one?
That was a good movie.
All of them seem to be like, okay, this is new 3D technology for The Walk. This is new motion capture face technology for The Polar Express, which I still hate that movie.
Let's be fair. While we're not fans of that, that does have an audience and people love that movie.
Oh, absolutely it does. But it's that weird uncanny valley that really drove me away from the film. I can't even watch it. It rubs me the wrong way. So at least with this one, it seems he's onto something there. I think that Zemeckis has stopped telling stories and is more pushing the envelope of technology. And what that reminds me a lot of is George Lucas. He stopped telling stories.
Yeah, and well, Zemeckis is one of the guys who's talked about maybe one day replacing all actors.
Aha. Well, this would be a good segue to that.
His best movies still use Cars, I think.
That is excellent.
It's only R-rated movie. Or at least at one point.
What Lies Beneath is. Well,
I don't think it is.
No. Doesn't matter.
Yeah, that's true. Let's fight. Vox Lux, that came out this week?
It's been out for a little while.
Okay, screw that. Throw it in. That's up to you then. You tell me.
I thought we already talked about it.
We mentioned it at on an episode that comes out next week.
Oh, okay.
Our year-end best of the year, we talk about Vox Lux. If you have nothing more really to add than that, then we can move on.
No, not really.
All right, then. Mary Poppins Returns.
Mary Poppins Returns. Yes, this is a sequel to the original Mary Poppins with Emily Blunt taking up the role of Mary Poppins some 20 or so years after the end of the original. She's come back to take care of the Banks children once again. This time it's Michael's kids, the three kids that she's going to care for while Michael is trying to keep the house. They're about to lose it to the bank that he works at, actually, interestingly enough. And he's trying to seek and find the bank notes that show that they've got stock in the bank that can help them keep the house. I love this movie. I did. I fell in love with this movie from moment one. This movie is full of magic and wonder and wonderful music. Emily Blunt nails this character. She really gets how to play what Julie Andrews was playing. Lin-Manuel Miranda is just a lot of fun. The kids are great. The animated scenes that mix with the live action are wonderful. And then when she sings Where the Lost Things Go, I'm just like, I lost it. I couldn't hold it in anymore.
Yeah, did you get to see this one? I'm sorry. Here's nope. Don't get married. I think that's the lesson you're going to learn from this podcast. Because I understand what you're going through. I agree with everything you're saying. I guess I just, it's not, again, it's not, the acting's really good. I thought Emily Blunt was almost better than Julie Andrews.
Honestly, yeah. Yeah.
I just, it's not a movie that I'm into. I'm not really a musical guy. But everything you said is completely true. It's just not my cup of tea kind of thing. But it's surprisingly watchable for something that's not your cup of tea or my cup of tea. I think anybody who likes Emily Blunt, whether it's the action star or the social media person with John Krasinski or whatever, however you like her in any fashion, I think that you should see this because she really does knock it out of the park. I kind of think this is the best thing performance-wise she's ever done because she really does hit a home run here.
Yeah, she does.
But it's just, I mean, we'll get to it with the classic too. I'm just not a Mary Poppins guy. So I don't know.
I adore this, and I was surprised. Rob Marshall's been kind of hit or miss since Chicago, and he really did a great job bringing this story together. He stays focused. The story doesn't drag. He really keeps things, he runs a tight ship, just like Mary Poppins does.
Yeah, like I said, it's very, very watchable, no matter what, you know, who you are. You're going to enjoy, you know, watch it with your kids or whatever. It's that kind of movie. Obviously, but let's just move on to the classic, which is Mary Poppins, if I can click the right button.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the main event for the linear, legitimate, and universally recognized, undisputed classic.
Mary Poppins.
1964, starring Julie Andrews and Dick Van Dyke. And Mary Poppins comes from the clouds to take care of the Banks children. Their father, George, is busy at work all the time. Their mother is kind of a flighty activist who's kind of always out the door doing something. And so she's taking care of the kids, and she's taking them on these magical adventures into animated lands. And Dick Van Dyke is along for the ride. And I love Dick Van Dyke. I know it's become popular in the past few years to make fun of his accent. And it's a bad accent, but I think it's intentionally bad. I think that's actually part of what he's doing here, is doing a really bad Cockney accent. I think he's doing it to make you laugh. And I think everything he does is about making people laugh. And I love that about him. He's so game and such a sport for everything. For me, when I was a kid, I used to sing these songs and just adore this movie when I was like 6 or 7 years old. This was the best thing in the world. Watching a really tall adult, you know, act like a big oversized kid was great. When he did the penguin dance when I was a kid, it just knocked me on the floor. That's the funniest. At the time when I was a little child, that was the funniest thing I'd ever seen. And it remains just as adorable as ever for me. I really loved watching this again. It took me back to being a child, and I still can't spell supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, but I tried.
But that song's still in your head.
It is.
I mean, since we've all seen that movie, it never leaves your head. At some point every year, that song pops up in your head. And, I mean, I guess that's something to say for the movie.
Yeah.
You know, the songs stand the test of time. Good or bad.
Well, I haven't seen this in at least 30 plus years. So therefore it was like coming to it for the first time and knowing full well how I feel about musical numbers and Disney films and Julie Andrews films for all that matter. It has nothing to do with Julie Andrews. She's a sublimely talented individual with a wonderful voice. Of all of the musicals that I could watch, her voice is outstanding and I love listening to her dulcet tones. I have to get that at least out of the way and talk about the positives of it. And it's such a positive film for the most part. She's really showing them how to live, these kids, and how to be good kids and good citizens and treat parents with respect so that the parents, who are shitty, by the way, mostly, especially the dad, start actually treating the kids as something of value. And of course, the dad ends up getting it, I suppose. But there's a point in the film in which we've gone through Spoonful of Sugar, which of course has resonated through my head many, many times throughout the years. I eat a lot of sugar. Then there's Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. I took it as a challenge when I was in grade school to spell that word. And I ended up as a spelling bee guy because I loved to be able to take that challenge on. It was the one thing I could really visualize and do. So this film really, it started to bring back a lot of memories of grade school, like second, third grade when I was watching this movie. That was kind of neat and nostalgic. Then about an hour and 15 minutes into the film, we get into a song about tuppence in a bird.
I forgot about this.
At first, I thought that that Julie Andrews was saying toppins, like just a toppins. And I'm like, you guys know that I don't hear that well, but I thought she was saying toppins. But then the very next effing song is also about that, but Mr. Banks enunciates it much clearer, at least in song form, than Julie Andrews did. So I heard that he was saying tuppence. Then I'm trying to figure out, well, what is tuppence? Okay. It's been explained to me that it's like 2 bits, you know? Okay, save up your 2 bits and then you can get that. But at about the 75th time that they mentioned the word tuppence, I checked out. Fully checked out. I said, hold on a second. I'm going to give this movie another chance because it's free. I'm watching it with completely open-minded sensibilities. I got an hour and 15 minutes into it before I started getting grumpy. I said, let me fast forward to the end and see how it goes. And if I think I like it, then I'll go back and watch the rest of it, okay? I wanted to be honest with myself that I was having a hard time getting through that scene. So I fast-forward it. The very first word out of somebody's mouth is Mr. Banks saying tuppence, and I turned it immediately off. I don't know what it is about this cutesy need to include proper terms in songs, and it reminded me of what I disliked about Sound of Music and disliked about West Side Story, and that's not fair to these films. It's not. It's just me and my personal sensibilities and how I hate hearing certain things over and over and over again. There are other lyrics, so I'm sorry, Mary Poppins. You are clearly a classic that has lasted 50 years. You're a wonderful film, and I can't watch you ever again. Bob?
I kind of understand what you're saying. It's like, I need a little negativity. Just give me something dark.
I'm definitely not the most cynical person in the world, but oh, just stop. Stop saying it.
But, I mean, to everybody's point, certain things, like, I forgot, I don't know why I forgot, but A Spoonful of Sugar, every time I take medicine I think about the stupid yep. song, and not, I'm not proud of that, but it pops in your freaking head all the damn time, and that's something to be said about this movie. It has definitely stood the test of time, and I don't know, my son watched it at school all week long, and then I offered to take him to see the sequel, and he was like, no, I'm good. While saying he liked it enough, I think he liked not having to have class to watch it, but he followed it and got it and enjoyed it enough, but had no interest in part two. I don't know. But I think part two is better, personally.
Yeah, I agree.
I must ask, fellas.
Dick Van Dyke's in it, yes.
Oh, no. Not interested in that part. I'm your angle on him in his egregious accent being part of his character, I bought that, too. I figured that was definitely a choice, because no one can be that bad at an accent and have them actually publish what he did, okay? At some point, he decided on that, and they were cool with it. Do they say Tuppence in the new film? Because if that's the case, I'm just writing it off right now. I don't want to watch it if they say the goddamn word.
No, I don't think so.
I don't remember. If they do, it's not enough to piss you off.
Excellent. Maybe I'll watch it in Spanish.
I mean, if you like Emily Blunt, that alone is worth...
I do. That's more of a joke than anything.
Well, no, I know, but... That's kind of the one for someone like me who really isn't into this type of positivity.
I'm not into this life-affirming family film stuff.
Emily Blunt is worth the price. I mean, Lin-Manuel
Miranda,
he's really great too. In a lot of ways, like The Favorite. I wasn't as into the story, but I thought the acting was fantastic. Same thing kind of here. The acting was just top notch, and the watchability, like we've been talking about, it's been a pretty watchable weekend outside of Holmes and Watson.
And Marwin.
It's just creepy. All right, let me see if we can find the 88 button.
Movie fight?
Number 18, yes. In 1988.
Movie fight. I will
do it. Squeezed and pulled and hurt my neck. 1988.
Right, we'll hit that again in a little bit. This is a long... Dang, I haven't had my soundboard in like, 6 months? Maybe longer?
It's been a while.
I don't have a sound bite for movie fight yet, but the movie fight is sequels that are better than the original. I know we got one comment on Facebook. It was from
Cousin Jeff.
Well, unless that was Josh. Oh, that was me. He said The Empire Strikes Back is the best sequel. And I suppose if I had to pick the three Star Wars movies, that'd be my favorite, I guess.
Yeah, I'd say Empire's better than the original.
I agree. It my favorite sequel of all time is obviously Aliens. That's in my top five. So, but at the same time, I know that in terms of a movie structure and whatnot, and its place in film history, Empire Strikes Back is probably considered the number one sequel over the original. I guess you would probably have to consider sequels that are good, whereas the originals were crap. Let's just take the X-Men franchise as just a random example, okay? X-Men United is far superior to the introduction film known as X-Men, where they just say characters' names, roll credits.
Here's
okay?
Who they are.
Yes. But Empire is truly a dynamic movie, at least in terms of the genre, because there's darkness involved in that. There's a Shakespearean element of family dynamics, and then setting it up with a cliffhanger like that, it's one of those all-time sequels. If it was the beginning movie of a trilogy, I can't imagine it being nearly as interesting as perhaps other sequels. But you can throw in Boba Fett in there, you throw in Yoda. It's definitely, over time, has become what I think is the best Star Wars movie. That doesn't mean it's my favorite, of course.
Yeah, I think the obvious ones are Empire, Godfather 2, Aliens, like you said. Kind of drawn a blank after that, though.
Well, getting into less classic territory, I would say that the Fast and the Furious sequels are far superior to the original. Not so much Too Fast, Too Furious, or certainly not Tokyo Drift, but the other ones, starting with Fast and Furious 3, and then you move on to 5 and 6 and 7, those are actually far better and far more entertaining than the original was. They've definitely taken that premise and expanded upon it and made it even sillier than the original was, and Far more entertaining by adding The Rock and Jason Statham to Vin Diesel and Paul Walker. I really love that franchise, even though I didn't love the first movie necessarily. I like it, but I loved what they've done with it, taking it in such a unique and silly direction.
I think you could make the same argument for the Mission Impossible series as well, couldn't you?
Yeah.
Like three on. Yeah,
the first one isn't very good, if you get down to it.
Yeah, for me, I just... It's for fun. I don't get to talk about Devil's Rejects that much, and I like it way better than House of a Thousand Corpses, which I like okay, but it's, I don't know, it took itself a little more seriously than House of a Thousand Corpses did. That was a campy little wannabe Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. Devil's Rejects is more of a wannabe Texas Chainsaw Massacre, so I suppose if you had Texas Chainsaw 2 and Texas Chainsaw Massacre backwards, I would like that better as well, so, but yeah. I don't know, it was... I really like Devil's Rejects. I think it's a really good movie. I know it's really dark. There's not a lot of fun in it, but I don't know, for some reason darkness is appealing to me, and I can't really explain it, but...
Well, you're right that it's better than the original. I would give you that, at least. we hadn't mentioned the Indiana Jones franchise. Some people consider Last Crusade a lot better than Raiders because Last Crusade is more fun and more adventurous and has a bit more comedy added to it. Out of nowhere, Blade 2 is better than Blade. Although I really like a lot of Blade as well. Blade
2 is awesome, though. Yeah, I would definitely go there. Spider-Man 2.
Yes.
And the original Spider-Man, by far. That movie is amazing. Spider-Man's good, but Spider-Man 2 really turned that franchise into something. It really made Spider-Man for me.
Yeah. Would you guys, as Raimi fans, take Evil Dead or Army of Darkness over the original?
I would take Evil Dead 2
as the
ultimate. But that's almost a remake because they didn't have the rights. Like, I mean, you look at the Lord of the Rings movies, and even with the Godfather, like 1 and 2 are so good Godfather wise that they're almost like a continuation. And I guess with the Lord of the Rings, I kind of feel the same way. Not that they're as good as that, but I just kind of look at it as one long ass movie, if that makes sense, rather than one being better than the other.
I completely agree with you. That's why it didn't. Of course, I considered it in looking at lists and whatnot, but it's the third part of a long. I said that the word long came out too long because I don't want to give any negative connotation to the Lord of the Rings films, but it's kind of the third part to an extended film.
Yeah.
I would say the Saw franchise qualifies as well. I think the Saw franchise gets better after the first one. The first one's good. It's a great start. But then the second one almost feels like it's the beginning of the franchise.
Yeah, I guess I'd argue that the second one's a little worse. But the third one, I didn't like part two. I think 2 and 3 are like movies they had in the... like they had scripts for that they turned into Saw movies. And then like 4, 5, and 6, they brought in the... guys who won like Project Greenlight and had them write the rest of the Saw franchise.
But everybody who was involved with the Saw franchise, like the writers especially, were definitely involved. Not from the beginning, but they were consulting with Lee Whannell.
Oh yeah, they were definitely consulting.
It was all part of an ongoing story, and they kept handing it off to people who were involved in the previous one.
Well, I know for a fact Part 3 was another movie that they turned into Saw. And I think 2 was as well. But again, you're right. They worked with them to make it work.
And something that I didn't include, too, that I think deserves mention, but the way that all of the comic book movies work, especially as part of larger ideas, The Dark Knight is better than Batman Begins to me. But then again, how many Batman movies have you had up until that point? And is that the 6th Batman film? Is it the 7th if you include the 60s one? In that trilogy, yes, it's the second part, but not starting from scratch, we already know so much about Batman. I kind of disqualified it for me.
Yeah, I suppose you could argue that. Well, I might like Batman Begins better the more I think about it, but to each their own, I guess. All right, let's try this again.
Number 18 in 1988. Squeezed and pulled and hurt my neck in 1988.
Squeezed and pulled and hurt your neck in 1988.
We had a lot of movies, new movies, a lot of 88 movies, too. Now, I'm not positive. I kind of did this on my own because normally I let Josh do it. Mm-hmm. But we may have talked about some of these. I think Watchers, the Corey Haim movie, moved up.
We did talk about that
before. I left that off. You can read it if you want.
The two movies I'm not going to get to at length at all here are Pell the Conqueror and The Girl in a Swing. Two movies I hadn't heard of until I made this list. Maybe they're worth it. I imagine somebody like Uncle Jeff will tell us all about The Girl in a Swing or something like that as being a strong... I don't know. He just tends to know about the ones that we haven't watched.
It sounds like something Steve Carell's character from the Marwan movie might...
Yeah, that's not bad. Let's see, Hellraiser 2. Hellraiser sucks. I've seen this one titled Hellbound as well. Aside from just different gore tactics, there's nothing to the lore of this that really matters with this or the third one or any subsequent sequel, I'm sure. It doesn't matter. It's just getting creative with S&M torture. There's nothing about it other than that. Mm-hmm. Let's see. We'll go with The Accidental Tourist. This stars William Hurt, and the plot summary goes, as an emotionally distant writer of travel guides must carry on with his life after his son is killed and his marriage crumbles. If I'm not mistaken, William Hurt was nominated or won an acting award for this movie.
I think nominated. I don't think he won.
Okay, and I haven't seen it myself.
It's homework.
It's homework.
It's homework. Trying to get through that movie. Yeah,
sounds like something that Neil Simon would have written. I doubt that he did, but The Accidental Tourist, for some reason, it just comes into my head as a quirky Neil Simon comedy. Then you read the plot summary, not so much.
It's the kind of movie that moms watched.
Oy, I'm surprised I haven't seen it. Speaking of mom movies, Beaches, shall we? Sean, did you ever know that you're my hero?
Oh my God, go fuck yourself.
Bob, everything I wish I could be. That's really all I know about this movie. And that women really like to see it. Women my mom's age really, really wanted to see this one and talked about it afterwards as a tearjerker in the same vein of Steel Magnolias, Fried Green Tomatoes later on, as it is an important film for them. Now, Barbara Hershey and Bette Midler are the leads in this one. I wanted to watch it this week to see what the fuss was all about. There's no way that was going to happen. So if either of you seen Beaches...
My Please. Mom has.
Oh, I was really hoping that Bob would see.
I mean, I'm sure it's been on when I've been in the house. I have no memory of seeing it, but that doesn't mean I have it.
I haven't seen it either, but something tells me that one of them dies. I don't know why, but I just have this strong feeling that Barbara Hershey's character dies.
Yeah, I think so too.
And that would mean that Bette Midler is going to sing Wind Beneath My Wings as a number in a set that she's doing in front of a crowd, kind of like Lady Gaga in A Star Is Born in a way, but like less impactful. But obviously those songs have been important to our culture.
Isn't Wind Beneath My Wings one of the most insulting songs you've ever heard in your life? It's so insulting.
Well, it's corny beyond belief, okay? But the melody isn't shitty. It's just... It's something that is so very 1988-89.
I'm trying to run through the lyrics to find the insult. You're my hero.
It must have been cold there in my shadow to never have sunlight on your face.
Okay, I don't know that many lyrics.
You were content to let me shine. That's your way.
Okay.
You always walked a step behind. So I was the one with all the glory, and you were the one with all the strength. All right, wow. That's enough of that shit.
I mean, I understand why it's insulting now, but at the same time, it's like...
Yeah, because Bette Midler's saying, I'm the one with all the skills and the talent, and you were the one that was nice.
Is that what she's saying, or is she saying, I'm the one with all the popularity, and you're the
one? And you're the one that's in the grave. I don't know.
You're the one that had the true talent. I don't know.
Sorry you're dead, but you're the wind beneath my wings.
Gary Marshall directed it, though, so I don't know if that means anything.
Are you serious?
Oh, really?
Well, when I was pulling together, I swear to God that's what it said.
Okay.
So. Wow, I'm so glad I didn't watch this. I hate him so much.
Up next for Gary Marshall, Pretty Woman.
It's the one, you know, Sean's kind of against the death pool, so I'm always trying to bring to the But Gary Marshall, Sean's proud of. He's like, I'm glad that guy's dead.
I'm so glad that guy's dead.
Not his sister, who recently died.
Who's a lovely human being.
And you know, made some great movies.
Were there an afterlife, he's not going to see her anytime soon.
There's not.
Gary made Overboard, so I'll never kill him too much for that. And I know how I feel about Overboard, but yeah, I do love that one.
Try watching Valentine's Day. That's all I can say.
I will not.
Overboard. It'll change your mind.
And really, I only watched the first half of Overboard. Now I get bored.
Oh, but the wonderful song. Oh, never mind. Anyways, okay, that was 87. This is 88. Dangerous Liaisons, another story of cruel intentions later on. It's from a novel, if I'm not mistaken, and it involves a widow and her manipulative ex-lover to make a bet regarding the corruption of a recently married woman. So it's mean people being mean to a really nice person and going from there. It stars Glenn Close, Michelle Pfeiffer, and John Malkovich, if I'm not mistaken. And I'm always mixing that one up with The Age of Innocence, where you've got Daniel Day-Lewis and Winona Ryder. Not the same movie at all. I've seen Dangerous Liaisons, and for all of the notoriety behind it, I think this is an Adrian Lyne film, maybe, or Barbet Schrader, maybe? One of the two. Point is, controversial director's controversial idea lands with a thud to me. I didn't think it was very sexy in terms of what it could have been. Of course, in the end, if you've seen Cruel Intentions, then you know that the corrupted woman, in this case it would be Michelle Pfeiffer, is the one that gets away as, you know, having been the better person or whatnot. But snooze fest.
Yeah, I remember seeing this way too young and not just being bored and not getting it.
Dangerous Liaison sounds a whole hell of a lot like an episode of Red Shoe Diaries to me, which I would much rather watch.
Well, yeah, but then you throw Michelle Pfeiffer in it and get all excited because you're a teenage boy.
But that's not the case. Not at all.
It's Stephen Frears.
God damn it, I love Stephen Frears. I'm a
fucking idiot. I mean, and I'll blame the age that I saw it at for the reason I don't like it, but maybe if I watched it as an adult, I would. I don't know.
Starry Stephen Frears, I love you. Okay, Working Girl is the last of 88, and directed by Mike Nichols, he of The Graduate and Primary Colors. I think I'm bookending his career well with this one. Working Girl got a lot of notoriety back in the time for being both Best Picture nominee and Best Supporting Actress nominee for Melanie Griffith. Did she win for Best Supporting Actress? I can't remember. But I know Sigourney Weaver, I think, was nominated for Best Actress, too, or something like that. It stars her and Melanie Griffith and Harrison Ford. Sigourney Weaver is the boss. Melanie Griffith is the opportunistic, plucky woman who's trying to use her creativity and her hard work to make it in the world. And Sigourney Weaver's character is just insufferable. And Harrison Ford plays the guy that's in between both of them. And it's kind of gross when you look at it, because Harrison Ford somehow gets the benefit of the doubt here for playing two women. But Melanie Griffith's character, at least, if you're going to watch this for anything, it's her. She's determined. She's really sweet. There's something really endearing about her that I like. And speaking of songs that will catch your ear a little bit, Carly Simon's got an anthem in this one called Let the River Run, which every time I hear that, I mean, I know exactly what time and place I was in. Third or fourth grade, sitting in class and wanting to get out of class and wanting to go home and faking being sick. And so having to hear that over the loudspeaker in the nurse's office.
It's like your JFK assassination.
What?
You remember where you were when it brings you back to...
Oh,
I don't know.
On a much different level, yes, you are correct.
Carly Simon is your 9/11.
Yes. You know what's funny is that they used Carly Simon's Let the River Run for the United States Postal Service after the anthrax attacks. Seriously, that's what they used as their ad campaign song. Now, speaking of Kevin Spacey, to bookend this show, it wasn't on earlier, but Kevin Spacey is in this as a very, very sleazy businessman that tries to take advantage of Melanie Griffith. And when you watch that or think about that now, all of a sudden it starts to get even creepier than his effective character in this movie.
I thought, you know, my favorite part of this is actually Harrison Ford. Harrison Ford is really great in this movie. He's really charming, and he's a really complicated character, and kind of that spiky sort of Harrison Ford kind of character, but also with a lot of charm. And you could see why women would just fall over themselves to get to this guy. He's got that kind of appeal to him in this movie, and he's also quite funny in this movie.
It was in terms of an acting performance, this and The Fugitive and Witness are the three movies that I hold them up on high for in terms of performances. But I had a hard time when I saw this for the first time liking his character, because it's like, well, it's really clear that you shouldn't play with Melanie Griffith here. I mean, if you're going to be Harrison Ford, the guy I like, you know, stop playing this guy that's kind of a player. I get it. He's a high stakes businessman, what have you. But yeah,
I haven't seen Witness yet, but I kind of look at Harrison Ford the same way you look at Jason Momoa. It's kind of a one note.
Oh, I understand why, because he relegated himself to a particular type of movie after, say, 1988.
Well, and even Han Solo and Indiana Jones are similar, you know, the way
absolutely,
they...
Absolutely, absolutely.
And then everybody he played after that kind of in that same vein.
I think he has a lot of... He speaks less in Witness and in The Fugitive... And in this one, and says more with what he's doing, you know, not on screen per se with his words. Is a supporting character, really, in this movie. He's better at it.
Joan Cusack and Sigourney Weaver nominated for Best Supporting Actress. Neither one of them won.
And okay. She was nominated for Girls in the Mist, too, wasn't she?
Yes, she was.
Huh. Probably why she didn't win. Too many nominations.
Well, she should have won in 86, but no, we've already talked about that.
No, she shouldn't have been nominated. Come on, it's an action movie.
She was nominated.
I know, she shouldn't have been.
Oh, come on. She was. I watched the winner, the Children of a Lesser God movie. She was better than Marley Matlin. That was still a great performance.
We all watched Aliens together.
I know. It's not like I don't think about it a lot or anything.
That's his 9/11.
Landed with a big old thud. Like a hot dump on a cold day.
All right. I apologize.
I need to quit apologizing. Next week, as far as I can tell, we only have the escape room. There's a shot a couple small movies may come our way. Because of that, we're going to do a Netflix challenge. I know for a fact, was it Bird Box? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Sandra Bullock.
That's going to be one of the three movies, and Josh and I'll come up with the other two. But we'll have, so that way we can kind of fill the show a little bit more. Plus, we need a break from all these Oscar contenders. And I don't know. I'm not getting married, so I've had the opportunity to go and sit and... It's exhausting watching movies, believe it or not. It's almost work. I don't know. I mean, I can kind of understand.
When there are movies like this, yeah. Because, I mean, this year, our Academy Award movies this year aren't very good, I think. Because, as will be evidenced by our upcoming Best of the Year list, the movies that, you know, there's probably one movie on all of our list that's guaranteed a shot, and that's Black Klansman.
Does that have a shot?
It's got a good shot, I mean, at this point.
If you were to look at our list, which you'll see next week, I think that would be our favorite combined movie.
I think it was in all three of our.
It was in all three of our.
Five?
You gonna do the math on that, or?
Pretty sure, because Star is Born is not in yours, and that was Josh's mm-hmm. one, my two, and then Hereditary was not in Josh's, and that
spoiler
was
spoiler alert.
Our one and one. Well, it's kind of obvious if you can listen to the show at all, all year long. But, yeah, so I think Black Klansman's our combined favorite movie. I think if you look at my list, a lot of the stuff that I saw early on before I started drowning myself with all this, like, I mean, the first movie I watched kind of in award season was, the Ethan Hawke movie, First Reformed. And then, nothing's really compared to that in terms of the season for me, so... I don't know. I mean, you saw what we talked about. The Favorite's really good, but to me, it's more acting than a movie. I don't know.
And Vice is a massive disappointment. Massive.
Yeah.
Mary Poppins at least has an outside shot for Emily Blunt, but that's...
And I'd be all... I mean, the actresses this year, again, are... I don't even know who I'd pick. I think my personal favorite would be Charlize Theron and Tully. But I could see Nicole Kidman getting it for whatever she did.
Destroyer.
Emily Blunt's fantastic. I mean, there's a lot of people that deserve it, but I don't know.
Toni Collette.
Toni Collette and Hereditary. Yeah, it's, I don't know. Hell of a year for the females. I don't know who I'd pick for the males. I think I'd lean Ethan Hawke, but I suppose Christian Bale's got a shot.
John David Washington.
What movie is that?
Black Klansman. Adam Driver. Oh, both of them. I would support that.
I'd be all for that. I don't know. I'd be surprised if that movie got as much love, but I don't. Maybe it will.
It's the one that's got, of the group of movies that we talked about, or we're going to talk about on that show, Black Klansman's got both a Golden Globe nomination and a Critics' Choice nomination. And SAG nominations as well.
What about A Star Is Born? I could see that cleaning up.
Yeah, it's in there.
To me, that's the safe bet.
That's probably going to win Best Picture.
All right.
But I dismiss it because it wasn't on my list.
I know.
It's an honorable mention on my list.
Maybe it'll be like 15 years later, we'll say, boy, Black Klansman really should have won, and A Star Is Born is great movie. It's amongst my favorites or whatnot. I'm reminded of 2003 with Lord of the Rings and Lost in Translation.
I don't know, man. A Star Is Born is pretty phenomenal.
Yeah. I'm listening to what critics say about it versus what people say about it, and there's not a wide gap or anything like that. It's more a matter of love, and really, really good.
I think Hereditary is going to be the one that's...
Yeah. I think the unfortunate thing for Black Klansman, it is much more divisive than A Star Is Born, which is a movie that's a lot easier to for a large group of people to coalesce around.
I agree. But yeah, so, and then I guess we can do a top five. I guess it's my week to pick, I suppose. We'll do top five movies looking forward to in 2019. Ooh, 2019 should be a big year for us, hopefully. I have goals in mind. I'm trying to keep track this year so we're not falling behind on classics and stuff. And Josh and I both turned 40.
Oh.
The man's about to get married. What do you got to do?
He turns 40 way before I do. I barely turn 40 next year.
What does that mean?
End of the year. I got a while. I just turned 39, so I got some time.
It has been so long since I've thought of it. I would like to thank you for entering, getting it into my head again.
But I'd like, we have some VHS. I'd like to try to knock some of those out for our Patreon episodes, and hopefully we can actually do more of those this year, but we'll see.
I've been 40 for a while, Josh. It's fine.
Yeah, the dread is not so much that
it's going on 3 years now. Jesus. Being 40.
You're almost 50.
I got no response to that.
But I guess that is our show. I do want to thank our Patreon supporters for supporting the podcast.
Here are Key Grip Levels, Jason Bryant and Charlie Messing.
Our character actor is Cousin Jeff, Christina Cato, and Josh Paul.
I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Our special effects level, Sarah Ward and Corey from Ivy Envy.
May the Force be with you.
Our associate producer is Jason from New Mexico.
Everybody has to eat shaving cream once in a while.
And our movie stars are Uncle Jeff and Dave Seavers.
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
If you want to be a Patreon supporter, head over to ihatecritics.net/Patreon. We also have the PayPal link if you'd rather do that as well. And don't forget our merch. If you want a mug, a pillow, a shirt, whatever, we have 3 designs up there right now. Hopefully we can... It'd be nice to add like one a month next year. Again, we say things, it's hard to follow through.
My son wore his shirt
yesterday
with clear pride, and it fit him well and everything. So we'll see if it makes it to school, though. That's the real test.
Teacher makes him put it inside out. This is offensive.
Is that thumb flipping me off? No. It doesn't say hate on it.
I listen to that podcast. They're terrible. They put me to sleep. It's a review I got today from somebody.
Really?
I mean, it wasn't bad, but it helped me fall asleep.
Hey, that's a good thing. I fall asleep to podcasts just about every night.
No, I agree. It's there's a comfort level there. Yeah. That's nice to fall asleep that way. But anyway, that is our show. Let's see. I guess we have a little time for Flick Chart unless Josh needs to go home. But we'll find out after the credits.
No.
Oh, do it. Thanks very much, Ray.
And we're the three best friends that anybody could have. We're the three best friends that anyone could have. We're the three best friends that anyone can have. And we'll never, ever, 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 ever leave each other. We're the best three friends that anybody could have. I mean the three best friends that anybody could have. The friends, the three best friends
that anybody. Say, I forgot to tell you during the show. The guys, Netflix is trying to buy me off on Roma. They sent me a Roma pillow, like a pillow just that says Roma, which is a great pillow, really comfortable. And now they're sending me a signed poster, actually signed by Alfonso Cuarón.
Oh,
and
really?
Framed. Signed and framed.
Wow.
Yeah, they're trying to buy my vote.
Is there dog shit on the poster?
Thank you. I was trying to figure out a way to phrase it, but you did well.
I hope not.
It's just nothing but dog shit and a signature above it. Or like in white Sharpie on it.
Are you going to consider that for your streaming challenge?
I might as well. I mean, I'm trying not to make this work because that's where I'm at now. I'm sure you have other things on your mind, but I'm exhausted. So, but I want to watch that Bird Box movie, yeah. So that'll be a reason to watch it. And we do have a little more time.
But my review of Bird Box is already on our page if you want to take a look at it.
And I had a friend, Corey, told me he watched it last night, and he wouldn't tell me what he thought. He told me what his wife thought. She liked it.
You want to have some fun? Go on Twitter and search Bird Box. It's hilarious. The Twitter loves this movie to the point where like the people are tweeting about the characters by their name. By name, they're tweeting about these characters in the movie.
Just tweeting and bird in the same sentence is weird to me.
Yeah, this movie is creating a lot of memes.
My wife started watching it, and I was not seeing what she was watching, but I could hear it, and I was like, oh my god, that sounds like the worst acting I've ever heard in my life. Now, I don't know what was on screen, but it sounded really bad from where I was at. But we'll see. I still kind of want to see it. Panic Room or Jarhead?
I mean, do you like mediocre or do you like mediocre with Fincher? I'll go mediocre Fincher.
Mediocre with a side of Fincher, yes. Really cool title sequences, too.
Yeah.
Terror Train, which I don't think I've seen, 1980.
I don't know that one.
All right, we'll refresh that because we do want to talk about the second one. Oh, man. Poor Josh. The Apartment or Lord of the Rings, Return of the King?
The Apartment.
Yeah, Return of the King.
A Terror Train would have probably lost. But we had to refresh. Mr. Deeds or Taken?
Taken.
Taken.
Kind of want to see them both in the same movie.
Adam Sandler playing Liam Neeson's character?
No, I want Adam Sandler as Mr. Deeds' character and Liam Neeson's character all. It's one of the movies coexisting.
Oh, I would love to see like Liam Neeson takes the needles and jams them into Mr. Deeds. That would be great.
Into his toe, and then it's black and it doesn't feel anything, just like in the movie. I don't have a problem with Mr. Deeds. The Avengers or the Black Dahlia?
Which Avengers?
The Avengers. 2012.
Not the Ralph Fiennes?
No, the Marvel first one.
As much as I like The Avengers, I am actually going to go with Black Dahlia because that is one of the great underrated movies of the past two decades.
I do remember your affinity for that. Avengers wins it for me just because.
For simply watchability purposes, I'll go with Avengers. Black Dahlia, I do remember liking. I kind of feel like I need to see it again because I need that recency bias to really put it above a watchable movie. Dawn of the Dead or Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas?
Which Dawn of the Dead?
78.
Dawn of the Dead.
I will too, despite Fear and Loathing's occasional interesting. Yeah, the recency bias on that should work too, but we
They're
also.
Both recent.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's Dawn of the Dead.
Role models or Emperor's New Groove?
Role models.
Role models.
Yeah, I like role models, but at the same time, it kind of ruined Zack and Miri Make a Porno. Because it came out a week after. And they released Zack and Miri on Halloween night.
Yeah.
So it was a failure. Seth Rogen's first flop. Machete Kills or Eagle Eye?
Eagle Eye.
Eagle Eye. Machete. Oh, Machete Kills. I hate the Machete awful. Movies. Ugh.
I like the trailer okay. But then they had to make full movies out of them. Kind of the one good thing about the Grindhouse movie not working was we didn't get Thanksgiving and
yeah, thanks God.
Women
thank
of the God. SS and all that.
Ugh.
Superbad or Anaconda?
Superbad.
You can take it. It's okay.
Anaconda would be fun bad if it wasn't for John Voight at the end with his thumbs up or whatever he did. Or his, yeah, it's super bad.
Lucky Number 11 or State and Maine?
Ooh, those are two really good movies. State and Maine is Mamet, and it's a comedy. I'm going to go State and Maine.
Slevin for rewatchability purposes only.
I agree, but I like both movies, but I agree. Slevin. Although I haven't really rewatched it that much, but
yeah. Why would you? How does that movie come up at all? Really,
only on Flickchart.
Yeah, I'm a fan of the movie, but it never comes up.
Christmas Story or future classic Serenity?
Serenity.
Serenity.
Fuck a Christmas Story.
I haven't seen Serenity, but fuck a Christmas Story. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid or The Illusionist?
The Illusionist.
Ugh. The Illusionist.
It's Butch Cassidy for me, but I'm not that married to it. When Harry Met Sally or Taxi Driver?
Taxi Driver.
Taxi Driver. Although I once again quoted When Harry Met Sally this week.
Sean showed me a podcast. They're doing Rocky. I can't remember the name of it. With
Unspooled.
Yeah.
With Paul Scherer and Amy Nicholson.
I didn't even pick up on the fact that both Rocky and in Taxi Driver, they say, "You talking to me? You talking to me?" I just, even though I knew. I always assumed Rocky was just talking about Taxi Driver, but they had a whole section of the movie where that was going on, or a section of the podcast. Trading Places or Planes, Trains, and Automobiles?
Trading Places.
Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
I love Trading Places. I do like Planes, Trains, and Automobiles as well, though. Unlike Sean. Snow White and the Seven Dwarves, 1937, or Bruce Almighty?
Snow White.
Yeah, I haven't seen Snow White in such a long time. I'm sure we're due for the Disney remake of that anytime now.
We got it already, didn't we? Kinda.
Well, is it Maleficent, Snow White, or is that Sleeping
well,
Beauty?
Then he had
Sleeping
that, Beauty. But then he also had that Twilight Chicks movie.
Is it Enchanted or
no? There was a Snow White and like the army people or whatever. I can't remember who was in that.
Oh, Snow White and the Huntsman.
Yeah, Snow White.
Yeah. Oh, that wasn't Disney. I mean, that's Universal. So I assume.
Oh, so they can still do it.
At some point, we'll get a Disney Snow White thing. Good. Snow White, it is.
Avatar or First Blood?
First Blood.
First Blood.
Always like when Stallone wins. Cool Runnings or It Could Happen to You?
Cool Runnings.
Two movies you haven't thought about in a long
time. Yeah. Took me a minute to remember what It Could Happen to You is.
I will go with It Could Happen to You.
I'll go with Cool Runnings just because I remember that one more. I do remember the lottery ticket trailer, but maybe I haven't even seen it. I don't even know. I feel like I have, but it's been so long. Desperado or You Got Mail?
Desperado.
Desperado.
RoboCop 87 or The Hurt Locker?
Hurt Locker.
Hurt Locker.
Woodstock, the documentary, is that?
Yeah, you can skip that one.
Jarhead or Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back?
Jay and Silent Bob.
I've lost already. Just go ahead and say
it. So once we get you to rewatch Dogma and Jay and Silent Bob, you're almost fully on board as a Kevin Smith fan.
I remember Tusk very well.
But Tusk is like old man Smith.
But those do require a rewatch at this point. Yes, I agree.
I think you will enjoy it, especially Jay and Silent Bob. I think you shouldn't. Maybe, I don't know. I'd be curious. I'd like to talk Dogma sometime at least, if nothing else. The Hunt for Red October or Million Dollar Baby?
Million Dollar Baby.
Agreed.
Yes. Sean Connery's eating can't save him. Tommy Boy or I Know What You Did Last Summer?
Tommy Boy.
Tommy Boy.
Closer or The Chronicles of Riddick?
Ooh, that's tough. That is tough because Chronicles of Riddick is a hell of a movie. But Closer, man, I love that movie. I love Natalie Portman in that film and Julia Roberts, Jude Law, Clive Owen. It's amazing. Closer.
That's a Mike Nichols movie too, isn't it?
I think so, yeah.
I'll go with Chronicles of Riddick, but guiltily. That's a real true guilty pleasure. That whole series
is really good, though. Really good.
Technically, I haven't seen that, but I've seen Pitch Black and I hated it. Closer.
It's way better than Pitch Black, though. We should have talked about it in sequels, honestly, because Chronicles of Riddick is way better than Pitch Black.
I really do like Closer. So can I just push it over?
That's fine. I picked Closer, so.
I know, but technically it should be a split since I haven't seen the other movie. The Core, 2003. I don't remember that one at all.
Hilary Swank. Aaron Eckhart, get your C team.
The Land Before Time.
The Land Before Time.
I am choosing The Land Before Time.
Oh, easily. Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows or About a Boy?
About a Boy.
Deathly Hallows, but, man, it's pretty close.
I like About a Boy better. Shanghai Noon or Tropic Thunder?
Tropic Thunder.
Yeah, I still haven't seen the Shanghai Noon movies. Don't plan on it. Somehow,
Tropic Thunder was written by the guy who made Holmes and Watson.
Again, I don't think I think it's the direction.
He also directed Holmes and Watson. He did not direct Tropic Thunder, though.
Pitch Black or American Wedding?
American Wedding.
Pitch Black.
Oh, fuck you, man. That movie's one of the worst movies I've ever seen.
Yeah, I wasn't a big fan of Pitch Black, but Chronicles of Riddick is so good it almost rehabs Pitch Black in a way.
I love Pitch Black. That's hard.
Pitch Black to me is almost unwatchable. I don't know.
It was my introduction to Vin Diesel. I don't know. It probably requires a rewatch. That was a 1999-2000 movie. At the time, the special effects were like just fine, and it was gorier than I expected it to be, too. It filled that void where Alien had been missing, you know? Maybe that's why, too.
Big Fish or Philadelphia?
Philadelphia.
That's tough for me.
We watched Philadelphia early part of last year. Philadelphia is amazing. So my like and what I know is right, I'll go with Philadelphia here.
That's fair enough. Ran, 1985. You know what that is?
That's an anime film, if I'm not mistaken.
Are you guys familiar with it?
No.
I am, but not, you guys aren't. So.
Okay, we're doing this then. This will be our final one. Crash, 2004, Academy Award winner. Halloween 5, The Revenge of Michael Myers.
It's Halloween 5 all the way.
Fishing with Gandhi.